My name is Dan Brown, and I am here today again with another Lenses on Information Architecture. Today, it is my great pleasure to talk to Jonathan McFadden. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you because of your focus on content throughout your career. The question that I've been asking folks to get started, what I'm genuinely interested in is collaboration, right? And how do we bring other people into this process? Whenever I'm talking about content with folks, it's either seems very abstract, or it's very, wordsmithing, right? It's sort of like at the very, how do you draw people in to the conversation about content? How do you involve other stakeholders in conversations and the content design process?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me, one of the most crucial elements, honestly, is documentation. Whether that's creating guidance, whether that is kind of annotating my thought process and my rationale for certain decisions, I think it really starts with showing people that a lot of thinking and a lot of decisions go into actually creating content, that we don't do this in a vacuum, that, you know, I may spin up a sentence, a copy, and from your perspective, that it took me all of 45 minutes or less, but really there was a lot that went into that. And so I feel like it's incumbent upon me to show you just how much that lot was. Some people may feel like that's a little too much and that that's extra and that we shouldn't have to do that. I think because depending on your flavor of content strategy, content design, whatever you want to call it, in UX, we are still facing what I consider a pretty profound knowledge gap. People, I think, depending on your organization, probably want to understand, but they've maybe never worked with a content designer. They don't know what that means. The formalization of that name is so nascent. And then you have kind of these other content disciplines kind of shooting off and being spun out from that. So, like, what does all of this mean? I think we have to educate. And I think one of the most powerful pieces of that education, or powerful outcroppings of education, really is getting into the project wherever things happen, wherever the work happens, and documenting your thought process and showing people how it works and using visualization as an aid. We did it in elementary school, visual aids, dioramas. Those things have not gone out of style. They're very helpful and useful. So I think that's one key way to do that.
So there's a lot there that I want to unpack, but I do want to call out that you said diorama, and that is how I pronounce it as well.
Kindred spirits.
But my younger son takes a class, and he always corrects me.
Oh, boy.
Says diorama.
Okay.
And I'm like, come on. So now I can tell him content designer pronounces it just like
exactly. He does. That's validation.
I need it. This was worth it for me. So I love documentation. Talk to me about an artifact or a framework that you've used that you love that has helped you capture that thought process or drawn people into the process. Can you be a little bit more specific with us about what is a good content design artifact look like?
Yeah, I think one that I helped work on recently would be a content hierarchy, since we're talking about information architecture, right? So creating kind of like trying to systematize how content appears, when it appears, why it appears in certain places along the feed. So I work on an app. And so we're constantly trying to figure out, like, how does this thing dynamically change and serve personalized experiences for users? One of the things I realized fairly early on is that we weren't really talking about, well, what job does the content actually need to do to earn its place there? My philosophy is that we don't create content in a vacuum, obviously, and that we don't just put things out there just to put them out there. Like, we're not just going to put this at this place in the feed just because we think it'll do well there. There needs to be rationale behind it. There needs to be some kind of evidence that we can draw from or linked to show that, okay, it deserves its place there. Like, let's not just put content there because we feel strongly about it. Let's actually put content there because it's fulfilling something, it's doing something. And so my content hierarchy work was all about mapping what we called our jobs to be done to actual content pieces and types of content that we were using on the feed already, and creating and some points of view around, like, this needs to go here because, and if this does not fulfill these criterion, it does not need to go here. And we need to be okay with, like, making those calls, using this as a template, using this as a framework that we're always looking back to. And if it to kind of inform basically how we treat this feed, this particular surface in the app, which is incredibly important and high visibility. So, I mean, that's one example. And I'm not here to say that my content hierarchy was beautiful. It was not. It was literally, I did it in a Figma file and it was wordy. So I was even like, even as I presented it and started to socialize it, I kind of apologized. I'm like, hey, I didn't have time to like make this all pretty. And, you know, I'm sorry. There are a lot of words here, but it has been an artifact that our team has been referencing and using. Product managers, product designers, UX managers have referenced this work to drive and shape the direction of the feed as it continues to evolve. And so what I saw as kind of a, listen, we need to think about this a little more strategically, and we're doing too much. And it's really, honestly, for my own benefit, I needed to do this because I'm like, good gosh, there's so much coming at me right now, has turned into an artifact that is very much in use again and again and again. And it may not be incredibly reflective of where we are now because time has gone on and things change and missions change and all that. But it's still something that people are using to inform their own work as they're working on this particular surface. So I would say that one, like a content hierarchy or content modeling, like whatever you want to call it, however you want to do it, I think that's very effective because at the very least, it gets your ideas out to the world and shows people like, this is how we structure content. This is how we think about content. Content is a living thing. And so because it's living and changing and altering and influencing and shaping things, it, you know, let's put some thought into what kinds of content are going in certain places.
One of the things that you said, that's awesome. One of the things that you said that really that also resonated with me is you were not preparing this artifact as a final deliverable. You specifically, whatever your reason was, you specifically did not polish it up. You specifically did not sort of make it, you know, something that would necessarily stand on its own, right? It was something that was meant to be used as part of a conversation, right? As part of drawing people in. And then I think a lot of our artifacts have evolved, certainly from when I got started in this business, to be less about documenting a single moment in time and instead being a place. It's almost a place for people to gather to have these kinds of conversations about content. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. When I was presenting the hierarchy, I wanted to stress that one of its attributes was fluidity. This is not going to stay the same. I don't want this to stay the same. Please don't think of this as a one and done type of thing. In fact, I am overdue on creating V2. Like, I've already made plans to create a second version because things have evolved. Conversations have evolved. The direction of our product has evolved. You know, we've had new people join the team. Like, there are so many different dynamics at play that if I were so rigid in how I thought about it, and I was like, this is it, it would be obsolete. Instead, this is, feels like a living and breathing document that no matter when we're consulting it, is always relevant. So one of the key pieces, I think, of presenting that hierarchy was giving people access to edit and asking people to give feedback and saying, like, if you don't agree with something, or if my thought process, you think it's a little like out of pocket, or I'm maybe thinking about this in the wrong way, let me know. Like, let's work on this together. I wanted to set the foundation. I wanted to build the skeleton, so to speak, but I did not want that to be the end of it, because I realized something as someone who is a content designer, which is loaded with all types of feelings of, oh, I'm not getting enough value. Like, people don't see me as a valuable contributor. I'm always brought in too late, or they just want me to polish some microcopy. Like, as someone who has that complex and deals with that, I know what it's like. You know, I don't want people to look at my, you know, I don't want to be a person who perpetuates this like siloed style of working. Like, I want to invite people in. I want them to know that, hey, I'm open. This is open. My goal at the end of the day is to actually get you to think about the content. I'm not saying like I have all the answers. I'm not saying my answers are always best. I've had product designers, product marketing managers come up with copy that was worlds better than mine. And I'm okay with that because it is a collaborative process. And so if I demand collaboration from other people, I need to also be offering that same olive branch and like creating the door and the space for people to come in and challenge me on my work and challenge my thoughts and ask critical questions that I didn't consider. The art, the hierarchy was just another means of creating that connection in that space, I think. And it's not the only thing, right? It's not the end of it. Like, we'll continue to evolve it, massage and finesse it together, which is what I'm really excited about, because I've already started like setting up some meetings and seeding the idea with people like, hey, I really want you involved in V2. Let's, you know, get together. Let's jam on it during a call or whatever. Let's work on this thing live.
That's great to hear. One of the reasons why I started these conversations is because I feel like a lot of folks are maybe a little bit in a rut, that we're sort of doing the same thing over and over again, that there isn't a ongoing critical conversation about the field of user experience in general, not to mention our specific areas of interest. I'd really like to take a new lens to content design or to user experience. Is there one aspect of content design that you feel like needs to be examined more closely? Is there one part of, if not content design, then user experience or even design more broadly, something that has been a long-held assumption that maybe it's time for us to unpack a little bit?
Well, one of the things you probably realize about me, Dan, is that when it comes to diversity, equity, inclusion, I'm a loudmouth, right? And so this is, we're gonna kind of, I'm walking back from more of the technical aspects of the work and now focus on the people aspects, because I think that's key. I mean, that's who we are. This is a people-focused job. And so I recently presented at Confab in Minneapolis, which, for those who may not be aware, Confab is a really big content strategy conference. And my presentation, my talk was centered on making space at the table. Inclusion requires action. And the crux of my argument was this. In our industry and in our space, we talk so much about inclusive design and inclusive language, inclusive writing. Companies that, you know, from A to Z, you know, Adobe to Zoom, probably have inclusive, well, I know Adobe does, but they have these inclusive language guidelines, inclusive writing practices. They have it codified in manuals and in style guides. That's great. That's important. I love it. I'm all about it. However, then you kind of take a look at the teams and the people who are working on the content and the people who are working in the product and the people who are making these critical decisions about inclusivity. And it doesn't look inclusive and diverse. And so if we want to create truly inclusive content, it's my contention that we first have to start with building and creating truly inclusive and diverse teams. Inclusive and diverse teams create inclusive, diverse content. That's my two cents. That's my mic drop moment. It's not novel. It's really not. But I think that is something that is kind of missing, that we're having these conversations. Yes, people are talking about, you know, representation in tech. People are talking a lot about representation and design, but how are those things actualized on teams, on content teams especially? Content designers are the gatekeepers for inclusive experiences. We're the ones who do offer the inclusive guidance. We're the ones who do, you know, make sure that we're not othering people or causing too much harm with the words we use or the videos that we put out or whatever the case may be. However, because we all come loaded with biases, and we all have our own prejudices, and we all have a very different perspective of the world based on a number of different factors, we are not enough. And our work in doing, like, in safeguarding, inclusivity and ensuring that, those are practices that are incorporated in the design of products can't start and stop at, these are the words we don't use in the product. Like, we can't just talk about, like, okay, this is why we don't use blacklist. This is why we don't use white glove. This is why we don't use powwow. Like, that's important, yes. But then that needs to extend to the people who are actually creating the product, who are actually building the products. That's what we do as content people. We are building and creating right alongside the engineers, right alongside the product manager and the product designers. We're responsible too. We need to reflect the people we're serving, essentially, that we're creating these experiences for. And I look at a lot of content teams, especially at the big tech companies, and the leadership is fairly homogenous. And like, these are the people who are creating these guidelines. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right. There's a bit of a disconnect for me personally. Right. And so, like, that is my, if I had to have a hot take, I guess right. That is my hot take. Like, that is something, like, we need to talk about HR and content design. Like, right. That's what it comes down to, hiring and talent. Like, that's what I think we need to talk about more. And that extends to junior talent as well, but that's a whole nother conversation. I can get so preachy about all this, but anyway. Oh,
that's exciting. the question is, which aspect should we get preachy about? Because you know, the hiring is almost, needs to be picked on, right? Hiring is a problem. And we have heard that, right? We know that, but I'm sort of curious what your take is on junior talent. Like, okay, let's say it's maybe not going to happen in my lifetime that we fix hiring, right? And that we've now have a means by which we can create diverse and inclusive content, IA, user experience, research teams, right? What do you think needs to happen for the junior folks who come in? What is it that you would like to preach about junior talent?
Yeah, I want people to realize that I feel like people who are junior, and I don't just mean people who are fresh out of college, I mean people who are new, who are fairly new to the space. So you could be, you know, it doesn't matter what age you are, right? That can apply to you. They represent an untapped opportunity, I feel. So when I think about some junior people I might consider junior, the people I know personally or I've met, these are people who have put themselves through boot camps, who have taken the initiative to get certificates, who have joined meetups, networked like mad, are, depending on age, now this is very much an age consideration, but or generational consideration, but these people might be digital natives who don't know a world without an iPhone. let's really think about some of the attributes of people who are not practitioners and are not jaded by office politics, are not desensitized to outside opinions because they haven't been enmeshed in the product area for years, who haven't done a lot of the work and are still very eager, very passionate, very excited about the craft. Why wouldn't we bring those people on our teams? Like, why wouldn't we want that kind of energy and that kind of excitement and that kind of skill set to be part of our teams? These people are self-starters. They are eager. They are determined. They will come probably with a hunger to learn quickly because they want to prove themselves. And most people learn quickly. If you put them in an environment where their income is dependent upon their ability to perform at a job, rest assured, a lot of them are going to do what they need to do to learn the craft. People aren't stupid. You know, we treat like, oh my gosh, they're junior. They're not going to get it. That's a lie. What? You had to get it at one time. Yep. Do you think it took you forever? I mean, granted, we're all learning. Like none of us have arrived and we're not going to reach the end of our learning. But like give them an opportunity to show you how much they can soak in and do. Great example. I use this during my talk. I worked at a company called Red Ventures. Briefly, it was not a long, I did not have a long tenure there, but that's a whole different podcast. And so I was a hiring manager and a manager. I was a manager there. And so I hired a team of content designers. And one of the people I hired was relatively junior. She had been out of college for just a year, but she had been a freelancer. That made an impression on me first because that shows grit. If you can come out of college and you're managing clients and you're juggling multiple stakeholders as someone who's relatively new in this industry and a young person in general, new to work, that means, okay, you've got some grit. You've got some, like, there's something about you that's innovative. You have some ingenuity, like you're creative, you're a problem solver. Those are the things that we need on our teams. Like we need those, I wouldn't call them soft skills, core skills. Like those are core skills that we need on our teams. Then she had an entire portfolio in Figma. I was like, okay, already, like, you know what to do, right? Like you're working in a product, you're working in screens. I saw the work happening in screens. Were there things that could have used improvement? Yeah. Were there things about how she wrote maybe, or how she spoke to users through the product that I thought like we need to sharpen this? Definitely. But okay, we can do that. Like that's not such a hurdle that we can't actually like cross, like jump over that, leap over that quickly to get you on this team. And so I just saw a lot of potential in her and I saw a lot of promise and she did not disappoint. In fact, I put so much trust in her that we were in the project we were working on is we were partnering with this external company to overhaul their existing web experiences and rebuild them with a better UX. That meant creating new tools and flows for users to make going through and understanding all the stuff we work. It was an HVAC company, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, working with all, like helping people like go through forms and go through flows and make the really big quality decisions about huge purchases. I put her in charge of a lot of the tooling and she did an exceptional job. She created new tools. She worked, collaborated with our user researcher and with our product designers to build these really great tools to help people just understand what they were about to do. And so I, you know, since I've left, she's gotten promoted to a mid-level role. She is a consummate content designer. She had product design prowess already. She sharpened that. And she took an avid interest in user research and helped develop this really close collaborative relationship with our user researcher so that we were testing content, testing prototypes, like putting those things in front of users quickly, getting results and feedback very quickly, and then applying it to the work. All she needed was about a month of onboarding to really start to get her groove.
Right.
She soared.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me about what you're saying is you, in the story anyway, you were hiring for potential. I was almost sort of like waiting for you to use that word, and then you did, and it really struck me because I'm a little outside the hiring game, just kind of where I am in my career, but I watch it unfold on Twitter, and it just seems like a hot mess. And part of what I'm observing now that you've said this is that people are, I think people are trying to hire to solve a problem, but they're not understanding that there's a two-way street that has to happen here. You've got to hire someone who might could solve your problem, right? But also requires a certain amount of investment of training, oversight. And the other thing that you said that really resonated with me is trust. Like trust is an investment that I'm going to make in this person. And the more they feel that and understand that, the more they will blossom, right? The more they will sort of live up to that potential that we also see in them.
Absolutely. Her name is Katya, and I'm sure she won't mind me using her name, but Katya did not want to disappoint anybody. Because again, being new to work, being new to the company, to the organization and the craft, she had an investment in herself. Like, I need to make this, like, I have to make this work. And while it may sound a little Machiavellian on my part, like, I knew that because I remember what it's like to be a 22-year-old coming out of college, starting a job for the first time. Like, I know the pressure I put on myself, and I saw her put that pressure on herself. Now, of course, as a good manager, I tried to be a good manager. I was like, listen, you're done at 5. Like, I don't want any of this whole overtime, like none of that. Like, take care of yourself first. However, I knew she was pushing herself. I knew she was invested in her own success. And as hiring managers, we can identify that and leverage it because it makes us better. It makes the product better. And I think we also sometimes give too much credit to the problems we're trying to solve. And I say that because we think we need a certain person with a certain number of years of experience on their resume to solve that particular problem because they have a specialty in it or because they're used to dealing with that level of complexity. Well, for one, you can hire a senior level, staff level employee and they utterly fail, no matter how much experience they have. And two, we deal with complexity all the time. Navigating college, university, whatever we call it, is complexity. Navigating life is complexity. She graduated during the pandemic. That's complexity. She managed to land freelance clients during the pandemic. That's complexity. Take what you know, the low-hanging fruit of people's life journeys and context, and actually figure out, like, okay, how can we apply this to the work that we need to do? How much, like, it doesn't teach people, like, explain the problem, figure out how they solve problems, and they'll be solving your problem soon enough. Like, the problem is not, like, I get it. Like, some of us deal with incredibly complex problem areas. I know I do. And as someone who is a senior and who has been working more than a decade, you know, I get it. Like, I know it's going to take me time to learn everything I can about the problem and solve it. But I also know that I've done this enough that I know how to work. Like, I know how to figure things out. That is something that is taught and develops over time. I can teach that to someone. I can help someone maneuver that. I can make that investment, and I have to play the long game. I have to think about not just, okay, we need to solve this problem today, but what about the problems that are going to crop up in a year or two? Do I feel like this person will be able to upskill enough that they can solve those problems too? Do I think that, okay, if I get someone who's junior in here and they like the environment, they like the work, they learn a lot and they have fun doing it, they'll stay long enough so that we're not worried about a mass exodus when the economy begins a downturn and tech jobs that pay a lot more start opening over here. And I'm worried about retention, right? Like, those are the things that I think we actually have to worry about. Because my thing is, Dan, and I'm sorry I'm rambling, and this is a shortcoming of mine.
It's so good. It's great stuff.
Well, thank you. Like, our industry, I feel like, is so top heavy with senior level plus, especially content design. You look for content design job title, like jobs, openings, it's hard to find any that are below senior. And I'm like, is that good for the health and longevity of our industry, especially when we're just now getting to the place where there's some, like, mass interest, I use air quotes, y'all, mass interest in this role, in this job, where UX writing is experiencing suddenly this groundswell of, like, mania, like, people want to do this. So does it make sense to just invest in, like, top heavy people who, oh, this is going to sound bad, I'll try not to make it morbid, but they're going to exit the space somehow, you know, like, it's going to happen. None of us live forever. There's churn, there's burn, there's attrition. Like, and if we only have senior level employees and we're relying only on senior level, staff level, principal level people to drive our products forward, well, we're just going to, we're going to have the rug pulled out from under us because they're going to leave. They're going to find better opportunities. They're going to make more money somewhere else. They're just going to leave the industry because they're burned out. Like, these are real things that are happening that we have to think about. And so when we're interviewing candidates, let's open the space to people who are junior and just getting started, because chances are they're not going to exit stage left anytime soon.
I mean, it gets back to what you were saying earlier about inclusivity as well. And I think the point that you're, and as someone who would obviously very fit the label of in the latter half of his career, it's important to me to acknowledge that there's still value and that there's still a role for folks like me.
Oh gosh, yes.
And what I'm taking away from what you're saying is, obviously the team needs to be broader than just a bunch of senior folks. What I have noticed, my personal experience, because I get to work with a handful of designers who are new to the field as well, that helps me. That makes me a better designer. Like, in not just surrounding myself with gray-haired folks or, you know, gray-haired folks, right? But having a team of a wide variety of experiences energizes me as well, right? And helps me prevent, not that it's all about me, but as I think about what creates a balance in a team, what creates a healthy team, that that balance of experience levels is important for everyone.
Absolutely. You know, Dan, we need the people who have been doing the work for 20 plus years, who are trailblazers, who charted the path, who made the way. We need them. They are the consummate vets who are going to, who get it, who have the context, who know how to do the work. They know how to do it really well, and they're leaders. But we also need the people who have no familiarity with this whatsoever, who are new, who are like excited and eager. Not that those people who have been practicing for 20 plus years are not excited and eager, but there's a different flavor of excitement.
Completely different perspective too. Yeah. A completely different perspective on the technology and the work. Yeah.
Absolutely. You're brand new. So you're like, everything is new to you. We need those people because they do infuse and inject our teams with a different type of energy that we just may not get if we're surrounded by an echo chamber. Like, if I'm surrounded only by people who are at my same level, similar experience level, like we're doing similar work, like I get things from that. Don't get me wrong. That community is important. But I learned so much from my direct reports. Yes. When I was at Rangers, so much. And they inspired me to upskill, to level up, to do better, to just be better in every way I can imagine. That is absolutely necessary.
Yep. So that brings us to sort of the third part of our conversation here, which is sometimes I just call it therapy for Dan, but free therapy for Dan. I recognize that I have a lot of preconceptions myself about information architecture and the practice of user experience more generally. And I was going to go in one direction, but I think our conversation has led me in a different direction. And if I'm very honest with myself, I believe that there are some aspects of doing information architecture that cannot be taught. That either you're wired for it or you're not, which is fine. There are lots of different kinds of people in the world. IA is abstract. IA is not very tangible necessarily, can often not have a very clear path between the work that we do in IA and what it actually looks like on the screen. It requires zooming out and thinking about a bigger picture that I think is hard for folks who are focused on screen level stuff. So this is my preconception, that there are some aspects of IA that cannot be taught. As I say that out loud, how does that sit with you? Do you think I'm right? Do you think that is a preconception that I need to throw away and revisit?
That's a great question. You know, as someone who wouldn't consider himself like this consummate information architect, or this like someone who is known for his IA work, I would say I feel what you're saying, because I probably, like, even in you reaching out to me about this podcast, I'm like, I don't know about this. I'm not a pro, and I'm not an expert in it.
But then you built a content hierarchy.
And then I built a content hierarchy. So I think, while maybe it's something that is hard to maybe teach in a conventional, like, this is how you do it. Because I think that's one of the things I feels like a nebulous, like, how, okay, people talk about, how do I do it? You know, looking back, I'm like, well, I've never called myself an information architect, but I do it. Like I do it, and I do it because I think in a certain type of way. I think as a content strategist, I think as someone who has a background in journalism, who has a background in marketing, who's able to synthesize those experiences to his work in UX. So do I think it's a challenge for people? Yes, it's a challenge for me. It's a challenge for someone who does this day in and day out, because it is hard to zoom out. You're right in that. Do I think it's something that most people can't do? I would say no. I think framing IA as something that technically we all do, you know, classification, structure, like those are, we do those types of things. We interact with those types of things all the time. The way you structure food items in your refrigerator, we can make an argument like that's IA. Like things make sense to you. And so you fix it in a way that makes sense. And so doing that in a product space or in a UX space, yeah, that could be tough. Cause it's like, well, I don't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that figuring out how to help people navigate a website is as complex as, or I wouldn't say putting things in my refrigerator is as complex as site navigation. However, I think we can distill those concepts to a very simple level and help people realize like you're already doing this now. Can you apply that to this problem, to this particular question? Some people will do really well. Some people will face challenges. But I think it does require a certain type of skill set that is honed and sharpened over time. So I don't know if I gave you a good answer.
You gave me a great idea. So the conversation I had yesterday made me realize that even though not everyone can do IA, we need everyone to participate in the IA process.
Absolutely.
So it's, I mean, you made this point way early in our conversation just now, that by creating this artifact, you were creating a space to invite others to participate in the process. And that's our role. That's, you know, let's call it half of our role at least, is creating spaces for other people to participate in this work. What I'm getting from this, what I really appreciate is, I mean, we've all used spatial metaphors to talk about information architecture, but there were things that you were saying earlier, like getting through college or getting through life is an exercise in complexity. So we've all experienced complex structures. We all know what being part of a system is. And yeah. I think part of our responsibility as information architects is to help draw a parallel between whatever system you have participated in and the system that we are trying to design here. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think in the same way we use analogies to simplify really complex, nebulous ideas, I think we should do the same when we're talking about IA. Like, okay, yeah, this looks complex. I know there are a lot of lines in my little diagram here. I know there are a lot of boxes and things that I'm using. When you think about it, think about how you go about your day and the steps you take. Like, they make sense to you, right? You have an order of operations on how you get ready for work. You have an order of operations on how you start your job or how you start your day. You have an order of operations on how you drive a car, like whatever the case may be. Like, you're thinking in this way. The challenge for us now is how do we, like you said, draw the line between the everyday complexities of life and the systematized work and the complex product work that we do. And so if we can help people like make that connection, we can probably help people realize like how important IA is, because I think that's another thing we probably can spend an hour talking about, like how valuable do organizations find it? It's incredibly valuable because we can throw people into all types of confusion and create all types of friction if we don't think about the architecture of what we're creating. And so, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know, again, I don't know how great that was, but I think it's definitely an opportunity. IA creates an opportunity to invite people into content collaboration. Absolutely. Because again, we're thinking about how, where things should go. At the end of the day, what makes sense we're sense making, right? So what actually makes sense?
And Jonathan, I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Dan, thank you. All my reluctance and hesitations were unfounded. Excellent.